Let's go ahead and get into an extreme.
Oh, wait. I've got one. Do Netflix homework. That didn't work the way I thought it would.
I don't even know what that was. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again from San Diego, California, is Keith Foster, the co-host.
I felt like you were building to something better. With me is the co-host, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Absolutely. And today we are coming back after another extended technology break.
I'm telling you, at this point, we're basically bi-weekly.
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much. I think people are okay with that. On bated breath. Every Thursday or Friday, depending on when we can record.
I mean, here's the thing. Our reviews come out so after the fact anyway, that it gives our listeners time to like catch up and see the movies.
Yeah, well, I always kind of figured not to get, like, too about talking about the show. But I always figured, like, the difference between what we do and what, like, the weekend critics do with their shows is we're kind of reviewing not only the movie, but sort of the movie as a phenomenon. So, like, yeah, how did it do? What are people talking about it? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, we review the cultural zeitgeist surrounding the movie.
Yeah. We review it when normal people probably ended up seeing it. Today we're going to be talking about Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs. We're catching up with that. And at the end of the show for our Netflix homework, we're going to be reviewing the direct-to-DVD sequel, an extremely goofy movie.
That's where we're at.
And that's where we're at. Now, at the beginning of the show, I like to open this up with what have we been watching, and I have a lot to choose from, so I'll let you go first.
Is it just what we've been watching? I thought it was just, like, what we're into.
It's an open book, this segment. You can do with it what you want.
All right. Okay, so I'll do two watchings. Okay. So for the past week and a half, Ashley and I have been rewatching all the Marvel movies that reference the Infinity Stones. We felt it was unrealistic to
remember everything.
Well, no, I mean just to rewatch everything.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There's like 18 now, 19, something like that. So we decided to just rewatch the ones with like direct references or imagery to the Infinity Stones. And I gotta say, I think sort of marathoning them like this, some of the weaker ones like Avengers Age of Ultron.
Right.
I really enjoyed on a second viewing. I was like, I can see how it is sort of a building chapter. You know, maybe I wasn't as hot on it at the time, but just sort of sandwiched in between all these other movies, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in here that I sort of took for granted.
Yeah, you know, what I always say about the Marvel movies, and I'm sure it'll come up when we review the new Avengers, is they're reliable to a certain extent. Like, even their worst movies are totally watchable.
Yeah, I just
like at this just, point when we're reviewing them, we're usually grading them on a curve. It's against their own material.
Yeah, but like I said, watching them sort of marathoning them, to me it just makes even more sense. So even sort of the weaker fare, I was like, yeah, I'm digging this.
You sure you're not just drunk on hype right now?
No, I'm sure, because these are, like, the old movies. Like, I don't think it would be shocking for people to say, you know, that they weren't too keen on Age of Ultron.
Yeah. It might have been, like, the week that movie was released, but that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I'm saying is that one in particular stood out to me is very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
I really, yeah. And the other thing I've been watching, the thing I was watching before we decided to go back and redo all these Marvel movies, Ashley got me into a show called Schitt's Creek. Schitt's Creek. S-C-H-I-T-T-S. Okay. It's a show by Eugene Levy and his son. And it's starring Eugene Levy, his son, Catherine O'Hare, and I don't know the actress who plays the daughter.
Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hare, that's almost like a little reunion of sorts for, like, the whole,
SCTV.
Yeah.
And actually, just recently they announced an SCTV reunion, and I wonder if it has something to do with the Netflix success of this. So it's a Canadian show. It aired on Canadian television, but it's getting sort of ported over for American audiences on Netflix.
Sure.
So it's sort of just catching on now, and they're about to start their fifth season, I think. And there's three seasons on Netflix, and it is a masterclass in comedic acting. Catherine O'Hare, especially, is so goddamn funny.
Catherine O'Hare is one of my favorite people, generally speaking, in the world.
Well, you should definitely check this out, because she gets ample opportunity to chew all the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't to say they're the only good ones. Actually, Dan Levy, Eugene Levy's son, is really funny as well. At first, when I heard he was doing a show with his son, I was like, is this like a Will Smith thing? But no, his son's really funny, really talented actor, and the actress, I should probably look it up to give her credit, who plays their daughter, is also super funny. It's just like very sort of old school character driven comedy. It's Annie Murphy is the actress who plays Alexis. Yeah, it's just a great ensemble comedy. Like, I think if you're a fan of shows like Parks and Rec, this would be up your alley.
Okay, yeah, I'll check it out. This week, or over the last few weeks, I caught up on Netflix, the Queer Eye reunion. Have you watched that at all?
No, I've heard the hypes.
Yeah, so there is hype, which is kind of bewildering to me, because, you know, like, it was of a certain age or whatever when the first one came out. It didn't super care. Like, I watched it a little as, like, a background noise on TV, like a lot of people did.
Sure.
But that's pretty much the highest regard I ever gave it. And then, like, years later, like, along with a lot of other people, I kind of thought, like, maybe it was kind of tone deaf and, like, kind of, like, weird. And, like, maybe, like, we wouldn't do that now. And so then when I hear that it came out again, I was like, oh, okay.
Maybe we would do that now.
Maybe we would. And it, like, and then to hear, like, people I have a lot of trust in saying it was actually, like, really good. And then I had to check it out of curiosity. And it's really good. I mean, it is what it is. It is definitely a reality show, a makeover show, whatever. But
you know what? I'm not 16 anymore. I'm not at the age where I have to bash something just because it's a reality show.
Well, you know, even then, like, I could tell, like, the difference of quality between, like, one type of reality television show and another.
Yeah, I mean, reality TV has some merits.
Yeah, it's a genre just like anything else. I mean, there is a lot of it that's really shitty, but that doesn't mean that all of it has to be. And what I think this version of it does better than the other version, and, you know, they say this in every interview, is this time they spend a week with their person rather than just a day. So it's a lot of, like, getting to know each other, and there's a lot of, like, it's almost kind of manipulative, like, to a point, like, you see the formula for every episode and how they weave in an emotional arc. But sure. It's a formula that kind of works, and I really do like this new batch of guys. They're really entertaining, they're really funny. I don't know, are you familiar with Game of Thrones? As a Game of Thrones fan, I would be kind of surprised if you've never seen it.
It sounds familiar. Honestly...
It was a recap show that Funny or Die did, where this hairdresser, a real hairdresser from West Hollywood, would just recap the show the way he does, and he has, like, funny nicknames for everybody, and I always thought it was, like, mildly funny because I don't really watch Game of Thrones, but I thought it was, I was like, yeah, I can see why people like this. But he's the hairdresser guy on the new Queer Eye, and he's super funny, and I've also been listening to his podcast, which he does, which is really, really good, too, where he talks about, like, really serious subjects with these, like, learned scholars on all these different topics every week. It's called Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness, and I recommend both, so that's a twofer.
Oh, all right.
Let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
Movie news! Talking about that movie news!
And I will start with this article. We've been talking a lot about Steven Spielberg lately. The media has been talking a lot about Steven Spielberg lately. And this is the latest Spielbergian news to come out. Steven Spielberg set to produce his first DC film, Black Hawk, with eye on directing. So this is based on a pretty obscure DC title that I know nothing about. Since you have a higher degree in comic books, I'm going to ask you, Keith, what is Black Hawk?
Oh, man. I honestly, I had never heard of Black Hawk until this story came out. I'm assuming, it, just from, like, the art, and I think it's, like, a World War II thing, I'm getting kind of a, like, a Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos meets the Rocketeer kind of vibe from
it. Yeah, that's what I'm seeing, too. It says here, Black Hawk was first published by Quality Comics and later DC, and was created by Chuck Kuderia, with input from Bob Powell and Will Eisner. I know who Will Eisner is. And a small team of World War II ace pilots who are led by enigmatic leader Black Hawk. The comic book, they operate out of the hidden base known as Black Hawk Island and battle Axis forces. So it's kind of a pulp war comic, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, so I don't think it's, it doesn't sound like it's like a superhero thing.
No, I don't think, I think they're going to try and fit this into the DCU or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, I think the headline was kind of misleading with his, you know, producing his first DC film.
Right.
Obviously, Steven Spielberg is comfortable in that world.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, cool. I don't know. I think there's room for... I love, like, pulpy World War II action stuff. You know, I dug The Rocketeer. I'm even a bit of a closeted Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow fan, so...
Yeah, I don't know why that's so controversial, actually. That movie's a delight.
Yeah, it's fun. So yeah, I mean, I'd give it a shot. I'm curious to see how this goes forward. It could be a fun franchise. I hope they don't try to universe it too much.
Yeah, same here. And I don't think they would with Spielberg producing and directing it. Unless it did super well.
Right now it says he's set to produce it. And again, this very clickbaity headline says with eye on directing. So
yeah.
I think that could go a few ways depending on what his next, you know, interests are.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. It sounds fun. I'll keep my eye out for this.
Yeah, I'm vaguely interested. I generally sort of like Spielberg more in genre mode than prestige mode.
Yeah.
But I think he's kind of, even in both directions, he's kind of edging into self-parody lately. I've said it again, I haven't really liked a Steven Spielberg movie, like, full-on, unequivocally enjoyed a Steven Spielberg movie in kind of a while. So I'm always waiting for the next one that's going to wow me. Although I never saw that Bridge of Spies movie. Okay, what's the second story, Keith?
The next story is that right now Bill Hader and James McAvoy are in talks to join the It sequel.
Volume 2.
Yeah, so far I think Jessica Chastain is the only confirmed cast, obviously, except for Skarsgård.
Right.
I'm assuming will return as Pennywise.
I would imagine so.
But yeah, so Jessica Chastain is playing the adult version of Beverly. It looks like McAvoy is in talks for the role of Bill. He's the main kid with the stutter, right?
Yeah.
And Hader is set to take over for Finn Wolfhard's character. He was the smart aleck with the foul mouth.
Who famously in the novel, and I think, weird. This is synchronicity. Who's the guy from Night Court who just died?
Harry Anderson?
Anderson. He played the character in the 91 TV movie. Because he could do all the voices. And that's a thing in the novel, is that this guy does radio, and he's like kind of like a morning radio kind of dude, and he does all these like celebrity impressions, which we know Bill Hader is famous for doing.
Harry Anderson played Bill?
No, Harry Anderson played
Richie,
the smart aleck. And this would be the same character that Bill Hader would play.
Gotcha. I just thought that it made sense because, you know, Richie was sort of a comedic relief in the first movie. He's sort of that, you know, has that smart aleck quality. And yeah, I see it. I'm a fan of both McAvoy and Bill Hader. So, yeah, I think they're going to have to get some pretty likable actors to
play these parts.
Yeah, because I think part of the charm of the It story is the way it cuts back and forth between the adult story and the children's story. So, you know, they got to make these characters very compelling as adults if we're not going to get those flashback moments. Yeah.
Which I would contend they kind of kneecap themselves, especially for Volume 2. I think in Volume 1 you can just do the kid story and that's going to play just fine. But I think in Volume 2 it kind of leans a little more into the flashbacks. I'm very curious to see how that's going to play. I really am into the Bill Hader choice. That was a like Reddit fan casting forever.
So yeah,
just
that's
happening now. And I think that he can do serious. We've seen him in Skeleton Twins. And
he's
and
really good in Barry. Barry, too.
Apparently, he's very good. I think he can play terrified. I can see him actually kind of sinking his teeth into this thing really well.
I think this could be the thing that sort of makes him a movie star.
Sure, yeah, because it's going to do really well, too. McAvoy, I'm not as into, not necessarily as an actor. I think he's fine, but I don't want to see this cast be too star-studded. And I think somebody like Bill Hader kind of like subverting his Hollywood persona is interesting and different. But James McAvoy, I think we're going to be thinking too much about who James McAvoy is. And I kind of almost think the same thing about Jessica Chastain, although I think she's a little bit more of a chameleon. But
really? I don't know. I think, to me, James McAvoy makes sense because he's, even though he's been like a leading man in a lot of movies, I don't really think of him as like a movie star because he always does, you know, he always does take those sort of oddball roles or quirky choices. You know, even. Yeah,
maybe it's just that he's too attractive. Like, because I kind of see all the people in It for the most part being kind of like middle-aged schlubs.
I can see that.
He looks like he comes out of Central Casting.
But, I mean, you're going to say that about him, but not Jessica Chastain, who's like,
well, she's Beverly. Like, Beverly is, like, supposed to be this unattainable beauty.
Is she?
I mean, in the eye of the beholder, to the male protagonist, yes. So I can see that being fine. But the others, I would like to see just like somebody like a Scoot McNairy type, who we've seen in some stuff, we like him, but we don't like have a full idea of who he is as a person already, or like a Jesse Plemons, like that level of actor.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying, and you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll fill out the supporting cast more that way. I do like that the kids were all relatively unknown except for the Stranger Things kid.
Sure.
But I don't know, I don't have a problem with it. I get it. They want a star for their starring role, so. To me, James McAvoy, I think, makes sense because he is a star, but he does sort of ride that line to, character actor weirdo role a lot. So, I don't know.
I mean, he certainly likes playing in dark stuff. That's been his thing lately.
Honestly, after the first movie, I have enough faith in what they're doing that I hope they don't. You know, derail their own momentum.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last story. Taron Egerton is set to star as Elton John in the biopic Rocket Man, which is funny because of the whole Kingsman Golden Circle thing, where Elton John had a pretty big cameo in that movie.
It's almost a supporting role.
Almost, yeah. Like, right on the border.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that's... It's cute. Yeah, I don't need a Elton John biopic, but if they do it well, you know, sure.
I think Taron Egerton looks enough like
a young Elton John,
and, I think he's a good actor. Sure, why not? I don't know, I'm still waiting for this Rami Malek,
Queen movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little curious, like, what is a Elton John movie, you know, gonna be about?
That guy's had a life. I'll say that. Like, I think there's enough material there, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's fun. I mean, How invested are you going to get in any biopic is the real question. Like,
you know, sure. Other than the Freddie Mercury one, which I was way less interested once Sacha Baron Cohen left. Very little.
Exactly. Yes. So, you know, if they're going to do one, yeah, let's have fun with it. I think that already this sort of stunt casting, which makes sense to me. I'm like, sure, why not?
Yeah, and I like you said, I like Taron Egerton. I think he hasn't really been around long enough to show every side of him, but I know there's more there, just based upon what we've seen.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a role like this could be a good opportunity for him to at least, you know, show us what he got.
Yeah, break through to the next level.
Yeah.
All right. That's movie news. Let's go ahead and get into the reviews, and we will start with Isle of Dogs.
Did you ever make a fun little soundbite for the reviews section?
Not yet, because we don't really have a name for it.
Isn't it just like the reviews?
Maybe some like laser keyboard noises or something. I don't know.
Yeah, like.
Go ahead and give me a synopsis of Isle of Dogs, Keith.
It is set in a sort of parallel dystopian future present, where a governmental regime of Japan is anti-dog, pro-cat, and so they set about making the people of the Japanese archipelago, they set out a propaganda campaign to smear dogs, and due to overpopulation, due to a dog sickness, a dog flu that's been spreading, instead of looking for a cure, they decide, we're going to get rid of all the dogs. This is our opportunity. So they set them all on this trash island. But the mayor, I think he's the mayor of the archipelagos. His adopted ward is sad because his guard dog was sent to the Isle of Dogs, and he makes his way to the Isle of Dogs, where he will search for his former best friend.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you set it up through the perspective of the human characters, but the story is really all from the perspective of the dogs.
Well, I mean, there's kind of an exposition spew at the beginning sure. of the movie, and it is more complicated than just little boy looks for dogs, because there is all this government stuff going on, this propaganda stuff. Yeah. So, you know, I kind of went into it thinking it's just about this boy looking for his dog, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bones of the story for sure. The main characters, the dogs themselves are voiced, cause this is done in sort of stop motion animation, and, they're voiced by Bryan Cranston as the lead, Edward Norton, Bob Balaban, Bill Murray, and Jeff Goldblum, who kind of play the pack. On this island of the sort of mangy dogs that are sort of burrowing through garbage to survive, and they're pretty much given up on human society caring for them. There's also aboriginal dogs, robot dogs, all kinds of dogs in this movie.
It's almost like it's an Isle of Dogs.
Almost. And some people have pointed out that phonetically, Isle of Dogs sounds like I love dogs.
You know, that's kind of funny because I kept forgetting if it's Isle of Dogs or Isle for Dogs. And that actually helps me remember.
There you go. But yeah, you know, this is a Wes Anderson joint, and I'm convinced that we're going to see more and more animation from Wes Anderson as he gets older, because it kind of leans into everything he's about as a filmmaker and as a director, of these hyper precise, very deliberate shots, these super art directed mise en scene, pulling in, you know, the props, everything has to be perfect, you know, the books on the table, the pages that he lays out of the newspaper, the designs and ornamentation on the cups, and everything is very, 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 very particular. And it's kind of hard to control all of that in a real world setting on a set. You can, and he does as best as he can.
And but honestly, even his more recent live action movies have sort of
become
like the fucking hotel one. It almost feels like stop motion because of like how set directed it is and how shot driven it is.
He's always done, but it's become more and more so as he's gotten older.
Oh, for sure. I mean, compare the fucking hotel one. I can't remember the name of it.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah, the Grand Budapest Hotel to like
Rushmore
or the Royal Tenenbaums, where it's quirky, but it's just, you know, the Grand Budapest Hotel feels almost like a storybook, whereas the Royal Tenenbaums is like a quirky indie family drama thing.
I mean, there's elements of that, I think.
Yeah, and you can see him, like, you can see him building to it.
Yeah, and in his, you know, he's also one of those directors. And we did a whole, me and Richard, back when Grand Budapest Hotel came, where we reviewed his whole catalog. But he's one of those directors who's also been super copied since he's come out. And I think it's, in some ways, kind of made people sort of take that style for granted. And it almost is indicative of a certain type of preciousness in indie film that turn a lot of people off. But when you see him do it, you remember, like, oh, yeah, this is why we like this.
So I want to talk, before we get too much into the movie itself, since we do sort of review the reception to the movie and things like that, have you heard anything about, like, the controversy, the sort of whitewashing of this film? And I don't know, does that mean anything to you in this case?
No, usually not, but I would imagine, I don't know about that story. Is it because there's English speakers doing the voices of the dogs?
Yeah, because it is set in Japan specifically, and it is a predominantly, you know, white American cast. I don't know if you really want to get into it too much.
I think that is patently ridiculous, and it is people looking to be upset about something. I don't always come on this side of that, but that is totally ridiculous. This is an animated film.
Okay.
About dogs. And sure, I would say that given the fact that it's a mainstream animated film about dogs, that it has a lot of Japanese characters speaking Japanese in the movie and Japanese actors doing the voices.
I actually thought, yeah, that was, to me, that was something that was interesting about this movie was it did get sort of some backlash for whitewashing and for cultural appropriation specifically. But I
would say that is a little more fair. There is an element of exoticization going here, obviously, with the Eastern culture and like the way he incorporates that into what he does in art direction and music and all of that stuff. There's a certain mythologizing of the East that's happening in this movie, but I don't think that that's necessarily always has to be a bad thing.
I just wanted to bring this up for discussion, because I, like, to me, the voice cast, with the, you know, American English speaking actors versus the, Japanese speaking actors, to me was, like, very intentional.
Yeah, I mean, it's a component of the comedy. It's used a lot in a comedic context.
Like, literally, the dogs are speaking a different language than the humans.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, I thought that kind of lended itself a little bit to the story. That there is this divide between the way the dogs communicated and the humans, and that sort of led to the Dog Island predicament in the first place.
I also think, and it's interesting that we're getting into the what's the movie about stuff this early in the review, but I also think that it's very similar to Grand Budapest Hotel in this way. Both this movie and Grand Budapest Hotel, I think, are the most overtly political movies that Wes Anderson has made, but he uses storytelling tropes and uses different, you know, kind of this hyper aestheticized setting to be able to feed you the medicine with a spoonful of sugar in a way. Like, I think there's a lot here talking about population, about pollution, about government corruption, about all sorts of stuff, and activism, and all of this stuff plays kind of a heavy role in this movie, but it's a cute movie about stop animation dogs, and it takes place in this kind of otherworldly, kind of almost 60s-ish looking Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think, as far as the cultural appropriation goes, it seems to me that Wes Anderson is trying to reference filmmakers like, did you get kind of a
Kurosawa?
Yeah, Kurosawa.
Yes, a little bit. Or filmmakers like Ozu or any of the other Japanese New Wave.
So
he has definitely seen those movies. In fact, I would say if you see an Ozu film, Ozu movies are like, he was kind of like Wes Anderson of the 60s Japan. Like, he wasn't as quirky and didn't make movies that are, like, funny. Like, they're really, really low-key. Like, it's literally, like, movies about, like, paternity and family and, like, intergenerational relationships. And it's, like, you know, super art house kind of stuff. The way he composes the frame and the way that he's really into symmetry and the way that he uses his camera very sparingly and he uses camera movements very purposefully, I could definitely see that being a huge influence on Wes Anderson's style all throughout his career.
Interesting. Okay, I just wanted to touch on it. I mean, it didn't bother me. I wasn't even really aware of it until someone brought it up to me. I don't know. I guess if that is something that offends you, maybe this isn't for you. But I, to me, I felt like, I don't know. It didn't.
Right.
I didn't get any vibes like that. I probably would have remained unaware of it had it not been brought up to me. So,
funnily enough, it wasn't when I first saw the trailers for this movie. What struck me about the Eastern influence on the movie wasn't, I didn't think at all about like cultural appropriation, blah, blah, blah. What is he doing? I thought like, oh, he's making a movie specifically to travel. Like he's making a movie that he wants to do well in the East, that he wants to do well in Japan and China markets.
I didn't even think about that.
Because his movies are kind of niche anyway. I mean, he's big for what he does,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, they do a certain amount here in America. But if he can make it travel and it being an effects driven animated film that happens to take place in an area very close to those markets, I think he was thinking globally.
All right.
Okay. You know, just on a monetary stuff. So sure. how did we like the movie?
Okay. I'm a sort of two minds about it.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the animation. I really liked the character design.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the core story. But there was something about this movie kept me at arm's length. And I can't quite put my finger on what it was. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy it, but there was just something about it that I couldn't quite, like, fully
immerse,
connect with it, on, I don't know, on the level I sort of wanted to. And maybe, you know, maybe it's because, at this point with the emotionality of his characters, I'm convinced that Wes Anderson might be a robot pretending to be a human.
See,
but there was just something sort of cold and mechanical about it. And I don't know if that's from the stop motion. I've thought about it. I honestly can't quite put my finger on what it was.
See, I actually think that he's getting better, at marrying an emotional arc to his arch comedic sensibilities. Because, you know, this movie and I think Moonrise Kingdom and Grand Budapest Hotel have all been among his most arch. But I think that, there is a core story here that I definitely connected to. I think, you know, when it comes down to it, it's a story about a boy and his dog.
I know. And I really liked all of those elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was around the third act. I don't know. It felt like they kind of resolve the missing dog issue like a little too early or something. Because near the end of it, I was like, okay. I don't know. I feel like it kind of loses. It kind of gets away from the real story, which is between the boy and Chief.
It kind of goes into action movie mode at a point, and there's a lot of like third act peril, yeah, and that kind of stuff. That was one of my complaints about Moonrise Kingdom too.
It's like action movie, but quirk.
Sure, I mean they're set pieces. They're pretty, you know, elaborate set pieces at that. You know, battling robot dogs and all this stuff. But for the most part, I thought my only complaint with it is it's a little long. Mm-hmm. Like, for what it is, I think it could probably be cut down by 10 or so minutes. And it maybe not always as funny as I want it to be.
Yeah.
But I actually think the emotive qualities of the movie are a strong point.
Well, so. At the beginning, we're introduced to this pack of dogs and this boy, and there's a really fun dynamic there.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of it, like it hits a point where literally they just sort of get rid of like four characters.
Yeah.
And they don't really come back. And that frustrated me because I really liked those characters. I liked that, you know, and so I felt like it just felt like there was a lot of hanging threads, even though they do get resolved. It just felt like the movie was like, yeah, and we don't give a shit about these characters that you've spent
the whole movie with.
Yeah, the whole movie developing. And
I'll give you that. I know
it even kind of does that with Chief a little bit, and I'm like, well, that I don't know. I felt a little robbed by the end of it.
So there's two cinematic influences here that I can't help but notice, and I don't know if it's intentional or not, but knowing Wes Anderson, it very well could be. This is a little bit like a Saving Private Ryan story.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit like Apocalypse Now, structurally. So...
Okay. Well, yeah, but I guess if you're going to do that...
Well, what I was going to say, one of the big complaints about Apocalypse Now is that, you know, it's all well and good and cool for the first two-thirds, and then once we get into the Marlon Brando stuff, the movie kind of goes batshit crazy and sort of forgets what it's about. Yeah. I would argue that the movie definitely knows what it's about, and going crazy is the point of the movie. But, you know, if that were sort of the architecture he's building this on, then there could be some structural parallels there that bother people in the same ways.
Well, I guess if you're going to do that, though, I don't know. I feel
you
like
see Chief or Spots as kind of the Marlon Brando in the story.
Now that you say it, I didn't notice it when I was watching it, but now that you say it, I totally get that. Yeah, I can see that now, but that doesn't make me like that decision more.
No, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, especially with the pack, because I really think that's a funny group of guys.
Yeah, and it's...
Dog or not, those are four really great actors. And that's what I mean by the movie maybe wasn't as funny as I thought it could have been. Like, I think they could have played up those character dynamics more.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's what I mean. Like, there was just something about it that sort of pushed me away, despite my wanting to like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was just something that sort of kept me at arm's distance about it, and maybe that was it. I don't know. But like, compare this to Fantastic Mr. Fox, where I was just like tickled the entire time. I was just delighted. Maybe it's because I've already seen him in this realm of stop motion animation, so it's like, you know, I'm not as charmed by it. Maybe
also this movie, even though
the animation is smoother in this than it was in Mr. Fox.
Yeah, he's and it's a lot more. The shots and the effects and everything is a lot more ambitious on a visual level. But I think maybe one of the things could be that Fantastic Mr. Fox is based on a novel by Roald Dahl, so he has that framework to work with him.
That is entirely possible. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It might sound like I'm shitting on it, but you know, I'm not. I enjoyed it. I like how he does things. Like, I do like the shots. I do like the overall story.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how he sort of gives in to his idiosyncrasies. Like, some of the flashback moments are a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the story is sort of revealed, I really liked. It was just, it hits a point where it's like, the movie shifts focus and suddenly cares a lot more about this propaganda government, you know, corrupted government aspect, which to me was just sort of like the setting. In set dressing, but that becomes like the story.
I think that's what I was saying earlier on in the review. Is I think he's at a place in his career right now. Well, I don't want to say that because he could do totally the opposite in the next movie. I'm not sure. But if we're looking at Grand Budapest Hotel and this movie, which both have this kind of political drive to it, or at least talking about history and talking about social political topics in a kind of fantastical way. I do think that is the point of this movie, because that is one thing I that I tried to look for that middle of the way, and usually of any movie that I'm watching, and especially if I'm going to review it later, I try and think about what is this about? Because a movie like this doesn't necessarily have to be about anything.
No.
It could just be effects, it could just be cartoons, it could just be cute. But once I, like, set my brain on that and was looking for it, I was like, oh, this is actually kind of about a lot.
Yeah, and I did like all of that. It's just, there's a point when the movie shifts focus to be completely about that. And I liked it more as sort of this subtle
background information.
Yeah, and when that becomes the sole focus, I'm a little less interested in it because we've totally lost all the fun characters, and now it's only about that. There just wasn't enough for me to hang on to, I guess.
Okay, yeah. All of the things you're saying, I think, are there. They're definitely noticeable. They just didn't bother me as much, or I thought that those deficits were made up elsewhere. I ended up really liking it. Is it my favorite Wes Anderson movie? No. It might be my favorite animated Wes Anderson movie.
I'm curious, what's your favorite Wes Anderson movie?
Oh, for me, it's still The Royal Tenenbaums.
Okay. I think it's The Life Aquatic, but...
Oh, wow. That's a controversial opinion.
Is it?
Yeah, kind of. I would say that's definitely bottom tier for me, but as much as I like it.
All right. I guess that might have to be like a bonus episode or something. I wasn't with the podcast when you guys reviewed everything, but anyway.
Wes Anderson thought. So yeah, I enjoy it. I would give it a B+.
See, I'd give it a B-. I want to see it again. I think maybe, especially after you bring up Apocalypse Now, maybe I can appreciate it a little more.
That'd be a weird and fun double feature.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. To me, I missed sort of the charm of, like, George Clooney as Mr. Fox, and I don't know. I guess I just wanted something a little more in line with that or something, but... yeah, I think maybe after watching it again, I might appreciate it a little bit more. But yeah, I'd give it a B-.
All right. Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework then. An extremely goofy movie. Like I said, this is a direct-to-DVD sequel to 1995's A Goofy Movie, which was the movie carry-on story that kind of spun off from the television series Goof Troop, in which a teenage Max is being raised by his father Goofy and is embarrassed by Goofy being Goofy and making him go on a bad summer vacation. In this movie, Max is headed off to college and he wants to join the X Games, a school college competition version of the X Games that exists only in Disney movies. And him and PJ and the friend voiced by Pauly Shore are all headed off to go do this. Goofy gets laid off of his job and realizes he's not going to be able to go any further until he gets a college degree, and he has 1 year left to complete. So he ends up going to school with Max and embarrassing him, and somehow ends up on the competing team of the X Games. What did you think of an extremely goofy movie?
Oh man, where to start? okay, I'm gonna get this out of the way at this. I guess I'll start with the Goofy Max dynamic.
Okay.
Which in a Goofy movie, Max is frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
In this, he's borderline repugnant as a character. Just like, I'm embarrassed by how embarrassed he is at everything.
Right.
It's just like, you're just an asshole. I mean, in a Goofy movie, I think it works a little more because he's in high school. He's so hormonal.
He's 16 or whatever, 15. Yeah,
everything embarrasses him. There's like a cute girl he's interested in. In this, it's like he's just going to college. You know, like in college, nobody gives a fuck anymore. And this whole, like, X Games thing made it feel, like, a little too real to be, like, not real. You know what I mean? Like,
because
like
the X Games is a thing in real life?
Yeah, it's like a real thing. So,
I wish they had called it something else. I mean, we could
exactly.
get it.
Exactly.
That's
it,
what
like,
it was. But
it totally took me out of the movie. It's like, okay, this is... Who is this trying to appeal to? So I couldn't stand Max. And Goofy in this movie is such a manic, depressive, sad sack, borderline, like, fucking suicidal. He's supposed to be Goofy! Like, this is supposed to be a movie where he's like, just sort of... this whole... Goofy in this whole movie is like the scene where he's crying over the high dad soup.
Yeah, there's a lot of high dad soup in this movie.
Yeah, so... And touching moment in the first Goofy movie.
Yeah.
Because for the most part, Goofy's just like, oh gosh, I don't know why you're embarrassed by me, Max. And in this movie, it's just like, my son fucking hates me. I don't have a job. I got nothing going for me. I might as well just end it all.
Goofy does get it wet, though, in this movie.
Okay, yes, he does. And I don't know, maybe that's another thing about Max is in a Goofy movie, again, there was like the whole, he's doing this elaborate lie that gets out of control just to impress this girl.
Sure.
And in an extremely Goofy movie, Max has no real motivation for being the asshole that he is. He's just like, I'm going to go to college and be an extreme sports dick. You know what I mean? Like, there's no reason for him to be embarrassed, whereas in the first one, at least there's a believable motivation.
For sure.
Whereas in this one, Goofy is the one with the love interest. The sort of unnecessarily hot librarian, Mrs. Marple.
Yeah, it's a weirdly fetishized thing going on there. But, you know, it's a cartoon, whatever.
Yeah, but her disco look was good.
Okay, let's talk about that a little. So, there's like this weird, like, nostalgia 70s thing going all throughout this movie. Like, it comes up once or twice, and you're like, okay, it makes sense. Like, you know, he's a dorky dad, blah, blah, blah. And then it keeps coming up, and they're using actual source music.
Yeah.
And kind of like with the X Games thing, like there's a blimp that says ESPN on it, and I'm like, oh, I guess Disney owns ESPN.
Well, there's just a little too much real world bleeding into this.
Maybe to some extent, like,
because yeah, the idea is that Goofy hasn't been to school since the 70s, so like,
right, so fish out of water, blah, blah, blah. Not that him being Goofy isn't enough.
Yeah, and I think that would have been enough. Like, Goofy is sort of this... I mean, you know, all the Disney cartoons, I think, are a little bit out of time and out of place of the real world. Mm-hmm. And so, like, having him have this 70s connection was bizarre, I thought.
Well, and it kept coming up to the point where I'm thinking, okay, this is the director or the writer getting out their own fetishes. Like, this has nothing to do with the story anymore. This is just weird referencing for the sake of referencing. And in too much reality, I would say there is a severe lack of power line in this movie.
Well, yeah. I agree, because power line is this fun, like, pop star, this alternate reality pop star that they created to
yeah,
be
sort
of
Prince
this, like,
facsimile, Michael
yeah,
Jackson.
Michael Jackson surrogate. Which I thought was, you know, a fun alternate reality world building device.
Uh-huh.
And I think we could have had that. I don't know. I mean,
well, the first Goofy movie is a musical. It's not like Hunchback of Notre Dame musical, but there is song set pieces throughout the movie. Some of which are powerline, some of which come from the characters. This movie isn't. Which maybe they couldn't afford a composer or that kind of thing, and that's why we end up using more source music to sort of fill in that void. But it changes the movie, the tone, quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree, and it to me it didn't really work. I did. There was like a couple little things I did enjoy. I'm not going to say this movie was like devoid of joy.
No, it's mostly just. Aggressively mediocre.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a direct-to-DVD Disney sequel.
Right.
But I did enjoy the Beatnik chick.
Yeah, that stuff was kind of fun and kind of, like, dated in a weird way that, like, I could get into.
Well, it sort of felt the most... It sort of felt the most of the world of Goofy and Max that we've sort of seen before with a Goof Troop and a Goofy movie. Mm-hmm. It was like this sort of cartoonish parody of, you know, a Beatnik and Coffee Bar. Whereas yeah. The other stuff was, I think, trying to be a little too... so it left me feeling alienated. Like that scene where they first encounter Jock Rich Dick or whatever his name is.
Something Upper Crust the Third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That scene was, like, I thought really fun. But that was about the only one that really stood out to me.
Yeah, you know, there were just a few kind of mini gags in the movie, just like blink and you'll miss them gags that, like, you could tell were, like, the writer's favorite stuff that they were able to slip in there.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember them for the life of me now, but I remember, like, actually laughing at that stuff. Like, oh, that's clever. That one was for the parents.
I guess. I didn't notice a lot of stuff like that.
It was, like, stuff... Like, I remember, like when he got one of his papers back, there was, like, the teacher had written something funny on it, but now I forgot what it was. But, yeah, you know, it's whatever. Maybe a Goofy movie is one of those movies, like the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where... people of a certain age hold it up to a much higher rose-colored tinted standard than the rest of the world did at the time.
I don't know.
I think this movie's objectively worse.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole time I just wanted to be watching a Goofy movie. Mm-hmm. I almost did a double feature, but I would have had to buy a Goofy movie on Netflix, and I wasn't ready for that.
Right.
We ended up not having time to do that, but I really just wanted to go back and sort of rewatch a Goofy movie because I just, you know, that one's a lot more fun. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's the big thing is I think I could have looked past a lot of the other stuff if Goofy wasn't just like a sad, pathetic piece of shit. And it, like the whole movie, he's just like, oh gosh, I'm so depressed. And Max is just like, and I'm an asshole who wants to be an extreme gamer. And I'm like, okay, cool. I don't give a fuck about any of this.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. And I remember at the time when the movie came out, I was thinking, who is this for? Because
yeah,
I was young enough that I would have been into the idea of continuing that saga. But I was like, I don't want to see Max in college.
No.
Like, I can't relate to that. I'm 12 or some shit.
I also like, think there's just sort of a weird thing. I never saw Monsters University, but I think there's sort of this weird thing with like kids movies set in college because it's supposed to be college is when a lot of people are learning how to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't totally relate to that when you're a kid. So I don't know. There's something about that premise in and of itself that I feel a little weird about.
No, for sure. It's unless you're Toy Story 3 or Brave Little Toaster, I just would rather not.
But Toy Story 3 and Brave Little Toaster aren't the main plot points aren't
being about in college.
Being in college. It's about the act of literally separating from your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I guess they're kind of, I'm trying to shoehorn that in a little bit, but I don't know. It just felt not really fun to me.
No, yeah, I concur. I was mostly bored by it, but...
And the animation is cheaper, too. I mean, that's to be expected from a direct-to-DVD release, but...
Yeah, it doesn't play as well. And the voice acting, like, you could tell they didn't have as much time to work on it or to master it, even. Like, there was points where I was like, is this Pauly Shore? Like, why does he sound weird? And then I, like, IMDb'd it. I was like, oh, yeah, it's him. Yeah,
it's the same cast. But, yeah, it was... It just felt... Yeah.
Everything was a little bit more muted.
Here's the thing. It's fine if you're a diehard and you need to know how the Goofy saga ends. You're a
completist.
Yeah, it you know, it's not like terrible. It's not going to ruin your childhood.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, I think there is sort of a nice resolution to Goofy's character at the end there with the absurdly hot Mrs. Marple. But yeah, I didn't need it.
No. No. And this is the most anyone's ever talked about an extremely goofy movie.
It's true.
What did you have for us next week?
So next week, because Infinity War is coming out, seeing it tomorrow, I thought it would be fun if we revisited Wind River, starring Avengers alumni Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen.
Yes, a movie I meant to see and didn't. I'm glad to know that it's on there. That must have just been recently added.
It was, yeah, the indie crime drama.
One of those hyper-specific subgenres, microgenres that create ultra-violent crime dramas starring indie actors you love.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's the show. If anybody has anything to say about anything we've talked about, or you want to name all of our segments, you can do that through our email, jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also send us some audio hot takes for whatever we might be talking about within the coming weeks. I know Patrick thought he might send us a little something-something for Avengers. You're more than welcome. Please do. Anybody else, you're more than welcome. Please do. And if anybody wants to follow us on Twitter, you can @JabberPodcast. You can also follow us on Instagram @JabberPodcast. You can follow me individually @BCCassidy. And where would people follow you?
People can follow me @KeithFosterKid on Twits and Instas. That's Twitter and Instagram for the uninformed. Yeah, I also have some shows coming. If you listen to this before Friday, which might, you know, unless you're just dying to click on it the moment it comes out, this is probably passed you by, but I'll be at the Comedy Palace Showcase at the 7:30 show on Friday, April 27th. I will be also doing another round of book club and improvised fairy tale Saturday, April 28th at 9 p.m. at Old Town Improv Company. And then next week, April 1st, my other improv show, Slack to the Future, that's just a clever name. It's not really that Back to the Future themed, is playing at Torque Moto Cafe, at 7 on May 1st, that's Tuesday, and again on May 3rd, China City Improv at 8 p.m. All of these shows are on my show calendar on my website at www.keithfosterkid. Oh, I also just found out I got accepted to the San Diego Comedy Festival. So that will be at the end of May. That will be some more stand-up fun for you. I think that's all I have to plug right now. So
well, that's plenty. You can also follow us or listen to us on any of your favorite podcatchers, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, Player.fm, Google Play, and the Windows Podcast Network. And we have friends who also do podcasts that you should be listening to that include Rod and Denise over at The Listening Party, or Rod and Moksha, actually. Now they are interchanging every other week. The show is like an evolving, like, opening flower of a show. Every week it's something different. But yeah, every other week and now is Rod, and then every other week from that is his friend Moksha. He used to have another music podcast, and they're trading off on the Listening Party episodes. So you should be listening to that. You should also be listening to Denise's The Mascot Diaries. And who else? Patrick over at Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics, as well as Mike Valick over at Let's Start a Cult, and Bill and Brian of the Great Albums Podcast. And I always forget their code names, but you should also be listening to, I'm looking it up right now to remember what it's called, you should also be listening to Those Happy Places, starring two people I went to college with who don't want their names out there.
I also want to give a shout out to Adam Conney at the Adamant Podcast. He's been a friend of the show for a while now. Meryl and Bo at Campfire Shit Show as well.
Cool.
They have a pretty fun just shooting the shit podcast.
Absolutely. So until then, we'll talk to you next week.
And maybe love is the reason why, for the first time ever, we're seeing it eye to eye.
Is that from one of those Powerline songs?
Yeah, that's okay. From the Powerline song.
Okay, I thought so, but I wasn't sure. All right, that's that.